This is a reading from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the fifth paper, Obstacles to Transcendental Efforts, Subliminal States of Consciousness and Their Effect upon Discernment. In matters of religion, a field where the guiding intuition is of subliminal nature, being intangible and inscrutable, we find that many deciding factors for religious judgment are related to subliminal impressions. There is a large gap between the thinking of the scientist or materialist and the pursuer of abstract values. There are always doubts in the mind of these two adversaries about their own individual infallibility. The hard-headed materialist may come to doubt himself if he falls in love or has a precognitive dream, or if he witnesses a miracle, something not explained in his orderly book of rules on the behavior of matter. On the other hand, the religious zealot, who is convinced that the mundane or sensory world is illusory, or illusory to a great degree, will have his faith shaken if faith happens to be for him an accepted force, when some person closely related to him becomes seriously ill or dies. He rushes out and calls the doctor, or lives to curse the beliefs, or to doubt them seriously if he fails to call the doctor. A subliminal state of consciousness is a state of awareness that is very strong and yet very elusive as regards scrutiny or analysis. We may be conscious of something, of a force or strange ability within ourselves, and yet not be able to identify it or describe it. This state manifests itself to people under the influence of certain drugs, under mental shock, under prolonged mental fatigue, and sometimes in the period between wakefulness and sleep. They are not states of mind if we are to identify states of mind with self-observation and conviction. It is almost, if not impossible, to study subliminal states except subjectively. They are worthy of mention here because they invariably have an ability to affect states of mind and affect them in a drastic manner. A person on the brink of a nervous breakdown or the physical breakdown that is so often labeled as insanity generally is disturbed by many of these subliminal states of consciousness. A dying person, judging from deathbed testimony, has confusion of some magnitude as a result of strange consciousness states. We may correctly decide that subliminal states of consciousness are more dangerous in being blocks to finding our true self than these experiences which are labeled states of mind. I remember the early hours of anguish that preceded the great spiritual revelation, which is described in the three books of the Absolute. I saw the entire population of humanity milling upward as a heap of maggot men. Their pleasures were pathetic. Their pride in individual consciousness was pathetic. The whole scene, as viewed from my body-conscious state, was dismal and so filled with despair that I wrestled with my sanity, or that which we call sanity, that which affixes to the body processes a pretense of reasonableness and ultimate reality. Only when my cherished sanity seemed to evaporate did I realize that this vision was only real as regards the perspective of the minds of men. In relation to the Absolute, which is real reality, the whole thing was a mental tableau. It was a tableau of physical existence as opposed to ultimate essence. The tableau is very much alive until we realize that it is mental. When we are about to step out of the mental into pure essence, we still have with us the memories of our evanescent intelligence and the memories of relatives, particularly those of our children, who are but the sad extensions of our game-playing. We are aware that these children still believe that they are real, meaning that their self-estimate is not questioned by them. and this is momentarily torturous, since in our memory they are tied to us with love. I might liken the situation to one in which a person might fall in love with a mannequin or robot, or to a Galatea. In the game of life, such a Galatea has life breathed into it, but of itself it is nothing. And that which it imagines itself to be is nothing. The being that loves the Galatea is no better than the statue. When the creator of the Galatea comes into the deeper realization, it sees the Galatea as ego-born fiction. This observer still has not crossed over and seen his corporeal self-belief as fiction. The observer is also a statue, except that part of him that is absolute. For the absolute is forever impersonal. A general summary of blocks. Everything cannot be verbalized, and the emphasis upon the states above is an attempt to show that things happen to us and have great influence on our essence and cannot always be described with words. Likewise, there is no book of symptoms that covers all the blocks that may be generated by these states, nor is there a word book of any sort that will list the manners of surmounting each block. Without perfected intuition, we are lost. In examining the systems that have endured in whole or in part down through the ages, we find that nearly all religions recognize that a sort of battle had to be fought to achieve anything that might be identified as spiritual accomplishment. Now, we might say that we are not necessarily interested in religion in this writing as much as we are in thinking and in understanding the essence of man, all of which might well come under the heading of psychology or super psychology. And, of course, when we say that we are interested in psychology here, we are not referring to the pseudoscience that is peddled by the political hucksters of social amenities. We find ourselves dealing with mental processes. We find ourselves dealing with the same abstract plane that is the battleground of mystics and theologians. And while we may wish to pretend that we are philosophers, and above all, the weaknesses that might be earmarked as having religious origins, we can only so pretend with facetiousness. We are looking for the tool to probe the abstract plane, and we find that the mind is about the only tool we have for the venture. Next, we look for yardsticks to gauge and keep a check on the mind, because we have discovered that the mind is unreliable and elusive. We are in extremely bad shape, in fact, unless we can find some way of monitoring this computer, which is continually suffering from emotional interference. Let us look at the advice given us by earlier prospectors of this field and consider the things which they consider to be obstacles to progress or success in mental and spiritual development. We have the seven deadly sins. They could also be called the seven obstacles to understanding. Pride, covetousness, lust, hatred, anger, envy, and sloth. These were published by the church long before the science of psychology was invented. Let us look at some of the mental blocks outlined by psychology and compare them. What is procrastination but another form of sloth? Exhibitionism is another term for pride. There are many trade terms for lust, such as satyriasis and nymphomania. Anger is considered to be an aberration, the result of incomplete knowledge or frustration with diverse objectives. Paranoia, in some diagnoses as such, may be nothing more than envy and fear. It can be seen that the seven deadly sins can be seven obstacles to clear thinking. But there are more. The first and chief obstacle to the pursuit of truth is nature, capital N, and nature, meaning both the nature of man and external nature, which is capitalized to distinguish the two. The nature of man is such that it hinders his thinking, since he must spend a good bit of his time thinking about survival in its several forms. By that, meaning his personal survival, family survival, and herd survival. Under the heading of personal survival, we may find his motives for seeking immortality, but his immediate daily survival needs do not do and must have precedence over post-mortem survival. So the appetites are a block or an impediment. The exigencies of living are obstacles, and bodily or physical limitations are an obstacle to the quest. We will get tired if nothing else. The body may be in pain, and while it is in pain, we will not be able to think. And most men wait until they are in pain before they feel compelled to think about life after death. Our glands may not be functioning properly, and all sorts of complexes and confusion may result. We are pretty much at the mercy of our natural limitations, which can be overcome to only a very small degree at a time. Consequently, the major religions hedge-hopped the issue of nature and concentrated on the mental obstacles. Only the priests and nuns undertook to negate the physical animal nature implanted in us by nature. They seemed to bargain the spiritual chances of the laity away for a respite for themselves, during which time they practiced celibacy, poverty, and fasting. As for mental obstacles, the word that expresses the most adverse force is called ego. We define ego here not only as egotism, but also being that composite of voices and urges known as personality, which in the final analysis is always false. Because the ego is such a significant negative force, we will come back to it later to give it wider examination. Let us examine a few more things which are obstacles. There is the laziness of the mind, which somehow must be tied up with physical incapacity or brain limitations. There is a fugue or flight from strain of thinking. Our curiosity will take us occasionally to the threshold of study, but something in the mind sees the work coming and takes the thoughts away in flight and escape. There are fears. There is fear of social rebuff, fear that the neighbors might find out that we are standing on our head or chanting mantras, or fear that they might discover that we have joined a group. There is the fear of hobgoblins. Brave men who have survived the battlefield cannot be dragged into a haunted house. There are fears of incubi or succubi. There are fears of spiritual contamination, and even fears of losing the soul, which we cannot intellectually isolate. Blind faith is an obstacle that comes in the category of rationalization. We should believe only tentatively. When we build on belief, we build cement around our mobile mental faculties, or in other words, we stagnate. Robert S. DeRopp recently wrote The Master Game, a very good book for serious researchers and for psychologists in the true sense of the word. He lists six catches: the think-talk syndrome, the starry-eyed syndrome, the false messiah syndrome, the personal salvation syndrome, the Sunday go-to-meeting syndrome, and the hunt-the-guru syndrome. Number one and number six speak of procrastination. Number one differs from number six in that the former may never get anything done but talk. Number six wanders from guru to guru, never stopping long enough to work diligently with any. The second syndrome, the starry-eyed, refers to those who, from a combination of emotionalism and weakness, blindly follow a particular teacher or system. This is an example of blind faith that aptly describes some of its motivation. The false messiah syndrome refers to those who have come to believe that they are a teacher or savior simply because they desire to be a figure of prominence. These sometimes are psychopathic pretzels or oversized egomaniacs. Which brings us to the business of ego. There is much confusion with the word ego. There is a big difference between the implied meaning of ego when Jung uses it and when Gurdjieff uses it. The Gurdjieff system teaches that there are many eyes which, by their multiplicity, split up the energy of men and weaken the power that might be spent upon self-development. The system further indicates that these eyes should be developed or used in such a manner as to lead to a more coordinated being. The system of Zen, on the other hand, leans more to the esoteric Christian view of the ego as being the unhealthy part of the self. This then interpretation, in contrast to the Gurdjieffian system, says that there can only be one eye for a perfectly functioning person. All of the rest must be discovered to be inferior and unimportant in relation to the ultimate destiny of man. It is almost amusing to witness the attempts by the mind mechanics to define the word ego. I maintain that the ego is false and has no functional value for the essence of man any more than an ingrown toenail would. To me, the ego is the aggregate of many urges whose ultimate value is more negative or harmful than good. The modern psychologists dare not quibble with nature and are obliged to rationalize for anything that is in that nature, that is, manifest. Let us examine Webster. Under psychology, we find ego to be the self. Quote, the self, whether considered as an organization or system of mental states or as the consciousness of the individual's distinction from other selves, end quote. The dictionary cannot take up too much space with each definition, and it is difficult to incorporate all that modern psychology does not know in a few lines. However, the first line of the above definition might refer to uncertain mental states or false states, while the second line refers to the opposite, the final observer that is aware of the other selves. Some psychologists see that there is an incomplete description of the evident phases of consciousness or the complex conglomeration of thought origins and mental reaction. And so they coined another word, id. From id, ego and libido are supposed to emanate. As long as the aliens continue to operate as public utilities instead of functioning as scientists looking for the truth, they will manage to keep doors closed that might allow them to understand the mind. Having denounced most mystics as being psychoneurotic, they will hardly dare to approach the understanding of the mind through any of the formulae approved by mystics. The three horsemen of dark visage and apocalyptic message for mankind are not pestilence, famine, and death. They are authoritative ignorance, enforced conditioning of the individual, and enforced conditioning of the masses. The first horseman is only ignorant. The last two are mad. They are respectively psychology, psychoanalysis, and sociology, and we are the unfortunate horses who support them. The obstacles of nature are the most subtle opponents in truth, and the exigencies of everyday living are the most immediate obstacles. However, the most formidable obstacles are contained in the ego. The sad part of this business of seeking for the truth is the fact that man's greatest enemies in the field are his external fellow men and his internal schizoid nature. There is no doubt that Zen attracted many great minds because of those minds saw the inescapable dangers of the attempts to categorize and scientize the study before all the data is in. The most that we can do by way of rational study of the definition of the essence of man before all the data is in, which means too long a wait, is to devise systems of study or to design new tools with which to evaluate the abstract values of the mind states. Zen, of course, goes to the heart of the matter. It is one also that works with the negation of untruth or a retreat from error rather than a proud frontal assault on ignorance with such primitive wall-scaling devices as concept building. So that even as the churches have become the enemy of truth by virtue of a downward chain of attitudes into rationalization resulting from fatigue, into concept building or dogma, into ritual as a replacement for interior effort, and finally into a domineering and fear-inspiring mundane authoritativeness, likewise the mind mechanics have aborted their noble cause. Those brash young men of the adolescent mind sciences are trying to reach suddenly, in a couple decades, a line of corruption which took several hundred years for the church to accomplish. So it cannot be advised too many times that we should beware of seeking the truth through modern psychology. Zen I consider to be the greatest psychoanalysis, but I use the word psychoanalysis only to convey the manner in which Zen functions. To the best of my ability, Zen works by negating errors and false structures with the aim at finding our essence. A list of obstacles of external nature. visible terrestrial life and planetary relationships. Invisible, or dimensions beyond our senses. Of internal nature. The appetites. Sex, security, food, pleasures. Other than sex, curiosity. The fears. Fear of dying. Fear of scorn or social harm. Fear of mental or spiritual harm. The blocks. The seven deadly sins. The six catches. Physical limitations. Economic exigencies. Forms of rationalization. That we will be able to do the thing better at a later date. Procrastination. That we will ride the tide of humanity into heaven. That social services or good works have spiritual gain. That the gods have ears. Salvation through prayer. That the gods have noses and eyes. Incense and displays. That positive thinking will make gods of us or lead us to liberation. That the guru will save us. That faith will save us. That spiritual paths may be evaluated by their popularity. That we can feel our way alone, intuition alone. That we can do it with our omnipotent reason. That God, or Mr. X, will take care of everything. This is a variation of the Knight on the White Horse rationalization. That our present belief shall be our final evaluation of truth. That everything is hopeless or useless.